Founded by Logan Esterling, Reed Design is pushing the boundaries of oboe and English horn reed making. They take the knowledge they've collected from hundreds of reeds and, with the power of machine learning, derive patterns and trends that accurately predict the characteristics of finished reeds while early in the sorting process. The result is quality reeds with characteristics you can count on. Using their products will save you valuable time and let you get back to what you love, making music. Visit www.reeddesign.io to learn more. That's REEDESIGN.io.
Specializing in the finest assortment of oboes, clarinets, bassoons, and their accessories, RDG Woodwinds serves musicians around the world. Their employees are all professional musicians who have a deep knowledge of the products that they sell. RDG's repair shop has an international reputation with a combined 100-plus years of service among the five repair technicians. Plain and simple, RDG provides excellent products and fabulous customer service. Visit them at rdgwoodwinds.com. They look forward to working with you.
Hi, I'm Galit Kaunitz.
And I'm Jackie Wilson. And you're listening to Double Reed Dish,
a podcast for oboists,
bassoonists,
and the people who love them.
So we are officially like back in person, which means I'm going to have to record sometimes in my office, which means sometimes you're going to hear background noise from the School of Music, which you may be hearing right now.
No, I'm not actually.
Oh, perfect. Well, yeah. If any happens to soak through, just think of it as ambiance and you don't have to pay extra for that.
I have three dogs in this room, so we'll get some ambiance, I'm sure.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. We're getting into that crunch time of the semester where it's a little more intense. I don't know if you're experiencing this. It's a different type of intense having been virtual and now being in person. Everything feels like, you know, that much more. But we also are officially into fall. And we plan to celebrate.
What are we doing to celebrate, Jackie?
First of all, you know, we had to bring back the reed decorating contest. Last year was such a blast. Oh my gosh.
It was like incredible.
Every time an entry would come in, we would just text back and forth. Oh, like, did you see this
Look
entry?
Look at this one.
Yes. Getting to share them all at once with everyone. Do you remember, like, some of our faves? I remember the vice presidential fly, and someone decorated a reed as the fly that landed.
That was so good.
And of course, our winner, here's Reedy, the Shining, famous scene from The Shining reenacted with an oboe reed. Like, we thought this would be fun, and then y'all took it to a different whole other place.
Well, you know what? Now is the time to step it up even more, because this is the second annual Halloween redecorating contest.
The prizes are better.
Mm-hmm. What do we have for prizes? Thanks to our amazing sponsors, Barton Kane and Chemical City Reeds.
Okay, so first, also, if you remember last year, we were just going to do the popular vote. And we were a little nervous if anyone would even enter this contest. So we were a little conservative. Now that we know people are into it, we're going to have four prizes.
That's right.
Top vote, oboe, and bassoon.
Mm-hmm. So one of each.
One of each. And you and I each want to pick a winner.
That's right.
Because we want to throw our power around. And, you know, it's our show. So we do what we want.
If anyone does a Buffy the Vampire Slayer reed tableau, I will die.
Oh, we're doing requests now.
Okay. If you want to pander to Galit, do something Buffy.
Well, I am a typical elder millennial and I love the craft. So I'll just throw that out there.
Nice. Nice.
And so each of those, that's four total, your winner, my winner, popular vote bassoon, popular vote oboe, gets $50.
50.
To Barton Kane.
50, y'all.
And oboists, you might be like, Barton Kane, that's a bassoon company. No, it's not.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Did you not get the memo? Have you not
they
been seeing
Oboe
these
Kane
videos
now.
Of every oboist?
They're so good.
Yes. Not only that, $25 to Chemical City Double Reeds.
That's right.
You can take your cane from Barton Kane, make awesome reeds, and get a reed case from Chemical City Double Reeds to
you
put it in.
You can get that piece that you've always been wanting.
Absolutely.
You can get that portable LED reed lamp.
Oh, yes.
Yes. You know, I've been looking at their stuff online.
I want that too. Maybe I'll enter. That would be kind of unethical. Right. But so every winner gets $75 in gift cards. That is epic.
And all you have to do is make a Buffy the Vampire themed tableau.
Oh, you do not have to feel pressured by Galit to make Buffy. But you do have to decorate a reed. The main part of the entry has to be an oboe or bassoon reed. We will allow English horn and contra. That would be fine. Mm-hmm. And be creative. Keep it tasteful. You have to come up with a name. Mm-hmm. And you have to email it to us by October 15th.
Puns encouraged.
Puns encouraged. Humor encouraged. Mm-hmm. Creativity stand out. You got to get those votes.
And we're going to really live it up.
That's right. Well, and so speaking of, since, you know, there are more options to go out and about, you might want to adorn yourself with
a hoodie, a t-shirt. Do you need a tote bag to walk around with? Do you need a water bottle? Do you need a sticker for your water bottle? Guess what? We have special limited edition Halloween Double Reed Dish merch. It is so cute. I literally bought 5 things today.
And yes, we do, because of how our merch is made. We do have to buy merch from ourselves. So
we do buy merch from ourselves.
Well, what does this merch look like anyway?
Oh my God. It's so cute. It's okay. I'm so proud that I came up with a pun. Okay. You know, we love puns.
Very punny.
So we have our Double Reed Dish logo with the two of us, but we are witches.
Transformed. Shout out to Alex, our Double Reed Dish graphic designer, who does everything according to our brand, so we can be branded.
And our brand is adorable. So absolutely. There you go. So our pun for our logo is Double Reed Witch. You know you want that sticker. Anyway, okay, so the next one is a cute little ghost holding an oboe and a cute little ghost holding a bassoon. And what are the puns, Jackie?
Obu and boo-soon.
That's right.
Well, and we tried to be, we love being a Double Reed podcast, but we get that maybe not everyone wants to, not every bassoonist wants oboe included in their fun and vice versa. So we tried to come up with some just instrument specific. Merch this time.
Okay, are you ready for this one? This is my favorite one. We did a vampire holding an oboe and a vampire holding a bassoon. And the pun is, only my fangs are sharp.
And we figured out this is actually a double entendre, because the first place your mind goes is intonation.
That's right. But it also goes with knives.
Yes, especially for those bassoonists. We got dull knives.
We know y'all can't sharpen a knife. It's fine.
So you could get a bassoon sweater and work on your entry for the Halloween reed decorating contest.
Uh-huh.
And your chance to win $75 in grand prizes from Barton Cannon Chemical City Double Reeds. Like, how cool
is
that? Thank
you so much to our sponsors.
Yeah, they're awesome.
We can't do anything without our sponsors. Thank you guys so much. You're amazing.
And it's going to be so much fun. The winner will be announced on Halloween. And then you can just, you know, treat yourself in November to all these goodies. But you got to enter to win.
Do it.
Do the Monster Mash. Don't mash your reeds.
Oh.
Consider buying your processed oboe and bassoon cane from those friendly folks over at Barton Cane. Processed with care and precision for your everyday reed making needs. Take the pain and injury out of reed making by letting Barton Cane do the hard, repetitive, boring stuff. Free up time for practicing, happy hours, hikes, baking, and spending time with friends and family. Barton Cane, here for you. Visit www.bartoncane.com.
Chemical City Double Reeds is a full-service double reed shop specializing in the sale of instruments, cane, accessories, and sheet music. Double Reed Dish listeners can enjoy free shipping with code DRDISH, all caps, no spaces. Visit them in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or online at chemicalcityreeds.com.
We are absolutely thrilled to welcome Dr. Darren Zupke, Assistant Professor of Bassoon at the University of Memphis. Welcome, Darren.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
We love to start by asking you to take us way back to when you first got started with the bassoon. So can you tell us how you got started?
Sure. So I'm originally from rural North Dakota. I grew up in a town that was, it's bigger now, but when I was growing up, there was only like 1,000 people. So no stoplights, no McDonald's, no anything. Closest like mall was like over an hour away. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of musical stuff happening apart from just being in high school band. So bassoon is just something that I kind of gravitated toward because I wasn't very good in sports. I have three brothers, pretty big family, three brothers and a sister. So I was the little gay kid that was not good in hockey or football or track. I tried them, but I quit them after like one practice.
I could just see you sitting there like rolling your eyes.
Oh yeah, yeah. I remember like crying to my parents that I didn't want to go to hockey practice. So
you're like, oh. No.
I know. Exactly. But so I found music. I started on clarinet and I wanted something a little more unique. So I switched to bassoon and it just, you know, it was kind of magnetic. It was weird and I was kind of oddly good at it just from the get-go. And just to have that like one thing that I was finally good at that I could sort of make my identity. Yeah, it just kind of went from there. I just became obsessed and I practiced tons. And eventually I wanted to get serious about it. So like around eighth grade or something, I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe it would be really cool to do this for a job because I like it so much. Mm-hmm. But I knew that there were limits to my town, 1,000 people. I wasn't sure that I was going to get into a conservatory just straight from my small town. So I begged my parents and to let me audition for Interlochen Academy. And they were, I was very fortunate to have, you know, financial support from them. And I got scholarship too, but so I went there for 2 years and I met Eric Stomberg, who I believe that you have interviewed, mm-hmm. our fearless leader, president of IDRS and, you know, does everything imaginable. So I studied with him for 2 years and he really, really prepared me for college auditions, got me up to speed with technique and etudes and intonation, especially. And yeah, I had always been kind of obsessed with this one bassoonist that I got her CD at a very young age, Judy LeClaire. And I just obsessively listened to recordings of hers. I still do today, actually. And I really, really, really wanted to study with her. But the problem was she only taught at one place, at Juilliard. And I was just like, geez, you know, it's Juilliard. It's so hard to get into. But, you know, my senior year of Interlochen, I worked just like a crazy person. I just totally practiced overboard because I really wanted to get into her studio. And I did, which was, you know, sort of the biggest, most important achievement of my whole life, basically, because that really shaped everything about what I do now. So yeah, and then I was at Juilliard for 4 years. I later went to Manhattan School of Music. I studied with Roger Nye, who plays second in the New York film. I was kind of curious about the way he made reeds, and he kind of changed the way Judy made reeds. So I was like, oh, I should maybe go to the source and try to learn from him. And I really learned a lot from him. So there was 2 years there. And then I had a couple years that I tried to freelance. I didn't do a very good job of it. And I think it's that sort of introverted, you know, little kid. Because if, you know, freelancing is so much about relationships and meeting people, I just wasn't very good at that. Mm-hmm. So I did that for a while. I worked just a regular 9-to-5 job, oddly, in a sporting goods store of all places. Like, I don't know how I got hired there, seriously.
Like this again.
Yeah. I was like, full circle. Yeah, exactly.
Did you put South Dakota on your CV, on your resume?
North Dakota.
It's okay. I think like I inflated my experience with skiing. I think that's and I liked biking too. So I think that's maybe what did it.
Did you have very outdoorsy written on there?
I don't know, even
sports games.
I think it was like my 15th job interview for just like a regular entry level job in New York City.
It is so hard to get those 9-to-5 grind jobs.
Totally. Absolutely. So I was ready to take whatever. And it was just hilarious that it happened to be a sporting goods store. But I actually liked it. I did it for a year and I tried to gig and everything. But yeah, so that was in between my master's and my doctorate. And so out of the blue, Eric Stomberg calls me. He's like, you know, I'm looking to fill a GA position. I wonder if you've ever thought about going down the path of like a doctorate and maybe thinking of doing university work. And I mean, I was ready to just, you know, leave New York, jump like into anything like that would save me. So he saved me at Interlochen and he saved me for my terrible freelancing career. So yeah, just out of the blue, he calls me and I'm like, okay, let's do this. Like, I'm moving to Kansas. So I went to the University of Kansas for 3 years. I got a chance to study the French bassoon, which is something that I kind of really got into during my undergrad through Kim Laskowski. And so yeah, that's what I studied there. And yeah, I basically took two or three sort of auditions, interviews for teaching jobs. And my second one was University of Memphis and the rest is history. I've been there for, I'm going into my fifth year. So last year before tenure submission.
Before we continue on your path, one thing you said that struck me, we're several episodes in now, and we'll ask people when they study with these quote unquote legacy teachers, right? And I believe this is the first time we've had someone talk about dreaming of studying with a woman and idealizing and just falling in love with the sound of. So I'd love to talk to you, though she's alive, though she, you know, she's a contemporary living bassoonist, you know, the same way we would ask someone about studying with Leonard Sherrow or with Simon Kovar, what was it like to get to study with Judy?
Oh, it was really incredible. I mean, seriously, it was just, you know, I wanted to have a career in music and I wanted to be able to support myself and, you know, I wanted to be in an orchestra too, but I think at the top of my list, really, and people don't always believe me. I don't even know if Judy believes me, but my first and foremost goal was to study with her just because I was so just like enraptured, just totally consumed with her playing. And I'm just like, God, how does she do it? Like, how does she make that sound? Because she has such a unique sound and phrasing and all of that. And so it was just kind of my goal beyond anything else to just really try to sound like her. And I just knew that there was only one way to do that, and that was to study with her. And I think, again, circling back to the little gay kid, it's you know, little gay boys and their moms or their grandmas. I was very close with my grandma. So I think it makes sense that, you know, men want to study with men. But, you know, it's very easy for, I think, gay men to not identify, but just be attracted to a strong female figure in their life. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably what has something to do with it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, really just listening to, I think I first got her CD when I was like 14 or 15 from the Charles Double Reed catalog. You know, I was
paper catalog.
Yeah, exactly. I think I just saw the image, the thumbnail. I guess you don't call it a thumbnail, but I picked those and I had a lot of CDs and I was just completely drawn to hers. And when I talk about, you know, I obsessively listened to her, I'm not joking. Like it was like an everyday, like many, many, many times. And I'm also not joking that I still do that to this day. I mean, she sent me, or no, one of her students sent me a recording, a recital recording that she recently did, like, I don't know, last semester or something. I've probably listened to it, like, not joking, 50 times, like 50 or 60 times, mm-hmm. just because I'm so inspired by her playing. I just think she's the best, you know, she just has a way of phrasing and the way she shapes her sound, her articulations, everything is just, it just really motivates me every single day. And I keep in touch with her. I mean, I was just texting her yesterday. So yeah, we kind of got pretty close during my undergrad, or at least I feel that way. Hopefully it's not a one-way thing.
You know, once she told me I had a perfect read, I was with her at Hidden Valley Music Seminars, yes. and she was yep. like, let me see your read case. And then she held up one of my reads and said, this is a perfect read. And I will never forget that. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know how that plays, but it must look good. And
that is so awesome. And that's the thing is like, she can just totally, just with one little compliment, just change your whole day or your whole week. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's stuck with you. It's like, I can remember certain compliments that she would give me that just, you know, they give me fuel, like they keep me going. And it's really, I think, special to have that kind of relationship. And it kind of informs my teaching. Like, I want to make sure that I'm very personal with my students and encourage them like she did with me. Because, yeah, it was just everything to me to study with her.
Is that part of why you decided to go? I know that you needed to get out of New York. But is that part of, you know, what led you to higher education instead of pursuing a more like strictly orchestral route?
I think, yeah, that sort of trajectory changed really slowly over time. I took a lot of auditions. I got some promising results, you know, advancing some finals. But it just kind of, the rejection started to sort of get to me. And I was thinking to myself, like I had subbed with a few big orchestras, and although I enjoyed it, it wasn't kind of like the ultimate thing that I always kind of imagined. I'm just like, oh God, people that play in the Met or Cleveland or New York Phil, they must be so happy and so fulfilled and the orchestra must be so perfect. But when I'm playing with these orchestras, it's like, you know, they still have intonation disagreements. They're not together because it's so difficult. I mean, the same challenges that you have in youth orchestra or college, they're still there in major orchestras. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, God, like, not only is it so hard to win those jobs, but once if I worked really hard, kept working hard to get one, like, would I feel fulfilled or would I just be frustrated all the time? And so it really made me question, like, oof, like, should I keep chipping away at these auditions? And I think ultimately the decision I made was just better for me because, you know, teaching in higher ed is stressful, but it's a different kind of stress, a better kind of stress for me. And yeah, just over many years, that's kind of what changed my mind about going into orchestra mm-hmm. life instead of teaching. So, but luckily it worked out because I love my job. It really, I wouldn't have known this, but it's completely perfect for my personality. Like it's really where I was meant to be, I think.
I just love that so much. Yeah. And I have to, this is not even a question, but more an observation of how powerful your self-reflection and insight into what you ultimately need and want. Like, it seems like even from a very young age, you know, coming from a town of 1,000 and having the savvy to know that you need to go to Interlock, you know what I mean? Like, and then saying, okay, well, if I want to study with this person, this is what I have to do. And then going to New York and then figuring out, okay, this is not what I want. Now I'm going to change completely and go to Kansas. It just seems like you're really willing to listen to yourself and take the necessary risk. And I admire that very much, because it's really easy to say, well, this is what people would kill to do this. So I'm going to stay on this track, even though it doesn't really make me happy. You know?
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, well, and just, you know, I hate the word pedigree, but you went to some very fine conservatories where I would guess there were certain kind of assumptions about the path and definitions of success. I mean, even beyond the schools you went to, we know that that exists in the field, and having the autonomy to divest from, I have the ability to maybe win a job like this, but it's not what I want. And so I'm going to have my own definition of success, which is to have a life filled with the bassoon, but I don't think this will make me happy. And even though it might impress a lot of people, that's not what I need to do. And I feel like one of our other interviewees, Alex Davis, talked about sometimes we do things for the eyes of our colleagues, and sometimes we do things for ourselves or our audience, and that it can be very hard to make the shift from doing things for the eyes of our colleagues. And yeah, I agree with you, Galit. We need to highlight whenever people do that, because it's such an important message, especially for the generation coming up and determining what their careers are going to and need to look like.
Also, Darren, how did you know what I was talking about in therapy the other day?
Because I was talking about the same thing in my therapy.
And there's nothing wrong with orchestra. Like, people can pursue orchestra if that's what makes them happy. But the idea is we should ask ourselves, you know, and
we should ask our students. We should ask ourselves, and we should ask our students.
Yeah.
That's what I tell my students, because, you know, my desire to study with Judy, I mean, it was cool, the, you know, mystique or the prestige of Juilliard, but I wasn't going to Juilliard to go to Juilliard. That was literally the only place that she taught. I mean, had she taught somewhere else, I probably easier could have gone there or something. Mm-hmm. But that's why I tell my students, they're looking at grad schools, and I'm just like, okay, maybe think about 6 schools, but really try to find recordings of these teachers at these sort of bigger schools, Rice and all places like that. And you should really be just caught up in the way that they play. Because that's the most important thing. I mean, school is great, and if it's fancy or you play in the orchestra or they have great conductors or anything, but it's all down to your teacher, I think. I mean, that's everything. And that's something I pitch to prospective students at U of M too, or at University of Memphis, where I teach, is that you don't have to go to Manhattan School of Music or Eastman or something to be successful. It's, you have to work really hard, and you have to have a very, you know, good connection with your teacher, someone that you trust. And so you don't have to go into $100,000 of debt. I mean, at University of Memphis, I think our tuition is only like $9,000. So mm-hmm. it's compared to other places. Mm-hmm. And we have such good faculty that have gone to like these, you know, prestige places, I guess. But it's really about the connection between student and teacher. And that's just because I'm going back to my relationship with Judy. That's how I feel really strongly.
You seem to be so driven and to have found really solid sources of inspiration. And have you had times in your life where that inspiration has perhaps run dry, or you had to figure out how to refill that well in order to come back to the bassoon at your job every day? Yeah,
definitely. The introduction to Maurice Allard, the French bassoonist pedagogue, and, you know, sort of the father of modern French bassoon. Basically, he taught everybody who's got a really big French bassoon job these days. He didn't in any way replace sort of my obsession with listening to Judy's recordings and being inspired by that. But after a while, you know, she only has so many recordings, and it's not that I would get tired of them at all, but sort of that of obsessive nature that I kind of have in my personality just got sort of refreshed with Maurice Allard, because surprisingly he has a lot of recordings if you dig deep enough, especially on YouTube, which is convenient. I don't have to go searching for LPs, but he has like a very similar quality that I think Judy does, that it's very phrasing driven, really well supported, you know, has sort of just this perfection sort of glimmer to it, that everything is well thought out and just very natural. And yeah, so that really came at a time when I realized that I could study French bassoon for real, because I couldn't really do that when I was doing my 9-to-5, couldn't really do it during masters or during the period where I was taking a lot of auditions. I mean, you just can't devote a lot of time to a secondary instrument. And so when those gates kind of opened up, I was like, ooh, now I can really get into his recordings and get inspired and
This is my moment.
Yeah, it was sort of like my second wave, I guess, or something like that. But yeah, that came at a time when, you know, the period in between my master's and when I did my doctorate, that was kind of a low time, because you're just sort of floundering and you're not really sure what you're going to do. I think a lot of students experience that after their master's.
I did.
Yeah, it's really hard to navigate because you just don't know what's going to happen. But that's where I did sort of cling to these Allard recordings, because I was just like, oh, maybe somehow I can do something with French bassoon. I've been wanting to do this since freshman year of high school, or freshman year of college, when Kim Laskowski gave me my first CD of his. And it just kind of snowballed from there. So yeah, that was definitely, he was sort of my second obsession person.
Okay, so Galit, you can chill out for a little bit, because now we're going to get into the French bassoon high.
Okay, I'm going to go get questions. Some coffee. I'll be right okay. back.
Yeah. So first, I mean, it is a Double Read podcast. We are talking to an educated audience, but I don't know that this is an area that all bassoonists even kind of deep dive into.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's a very big topic. But could we start by having you just kind of give a rundown of, like, if we have a listener going, French bassoon, what is that? What does that mean? What's mm-hmm. kind of like the overview entry level of French bassoon, German bassoon? This is Shark Tank. Give us your couple minute pitch on French bassoon, German bassoon thing.
Well, you need to edit in the soundtrack. Dun, dun. Okay, French bassoon is it's a completely different type of bassoon that evolved separately from the German bassoon, and it has at its core just a different bore. So it's a much smaller bore. It's made of different wood. The tone holes are in different places. So the intonation, and actually most importantly, the fingerings are quite different from the German bassoon. Yeah, so the mechanism, it's a very, very different. And you have to use a little bit different reeds too. But I think any bassoonist, if they heard one side by side, especially an older French bassoon like Allard, you'd hear a sound difference. Like if you were to say a negative adjective for it, it would be nasal, or, you know, something like that. But I think I hear it as clear and direct. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, to me, it's, when I first started listening to it, I can't say that I actually liked it, but it was so different that I was just very curious about it. And, you know, the more you listen to something, like if you don't like a symphony, but you listen to it five times, you kind of start to like it, right? So that's what happened with French bassoon for me, is the sound fundamentally is very, very different from the German bassoon.
I guess the first thing that kind of comes to my mind is it really is a different instrument. Yet we have all of this repertoire, solo, orchestral, and chamber, that we who play the German bassoon are expected, which we have a lot of international listeners, Americans play the German bassoon. And what is your perspective? I guess this is a two-part question. First, what is your perspective on if, and if yes, how we should be informed by the French bassoon when we're playing that literature? I won't do a two-parter. We'll start. I'll just do a follow-up. So this is the question. Like, if I'm in orchestra and I'm playing Debussy or Ravel, probably more, and even Stravinsky, who would be composing for the French bassoon, right? How do you think that should inform my performance practice in an American setting on the German bassoon?
That was one of the first questions that really drove my research. What I found from talking to French bassoonists is that, no, oddly, when I tell people that, they're just surprised, because you think that, oh, it's like performance practice. Baroque sonatas sound good on Baroque bassoons. So obviously French music sounds better on French bassoon, but that's not actually the case. German bassoonists can play French music. French bassoonists can play Brahms, especially nowadays. The modern, like the new generation, sort of the students of Allard and the students of Allard have really changed their sound so much that it's pretty close to German bassoon now, just because playing in that style helps with intonation and blending, which is kind of the direction that orchestras went in French bassoon playing countries. It was a huge surprise to me. And it was actually kind of crushing a little bit to hear from French bassoonists that, like, well, no, Do To You doesn't sound better on French bassoon. And they would like look at me like I was stupid. I think you can think about it in a historical kind of context, in more of an academic way, like, oh, wow, I can really hear how old French bassoon used to sound. And it kind of makes sense. Like Debussy would have sort of these solos for French bassoon that you would really want to stick out. Like, so you want that kind of brilliant, unique sound. Whereas when Brahms was composing, you really want to be sort of homogenous with the horns. So you can't really sound like crazy buzzy and nasally like a French bassoon. Like it doesn't blend as well. But over time, everything just kind of becomes like everybody, orchestras have to be able to do all kinds of rep. So that's why, you know, everybody is sort of expected to do and should be able to play all kinds of rep. But if you look at it from, you know, like I said, where things came from, it's cool to think that, you know, Rite of Spring sounded like, wow, this really crazy old French bassoon. But I mean, why would you want to play it like that now? It's just modern tastes have changed. Mm-hmm. And you just wouldn't do that. I think it's really fun to play French rep on French bassoon. Mm-hmm. Just because I think it's kind of cool. But to say that it's better or more informed, I think is kind of overstepping a little bit.
Can I ask a French bassoon 101 question?
Yes.
Why do Americans play German bassoons?
Oh, no, that's a fantastic question.
Yeah. 201.
Now I'm busted in my Shark Tank thing. I didn't explain it well enough. And Barbara's not going to invest. So, but yeah, it used to be more equal, or even more people used to play French bassoon. But as the German bassoon got developed in Germany through like Karl Allmenreder and Heckel, they started to improve the intonation, the response. It was easier to make reeds for it. Mm. And just kind of gradually over time, German bassoon overtook the French bassoon because it was easier to play. French bassoon, you don't have, if you make 10 reeds, you're going to get a smaller percentage of reeds that are going to work just because of the weird acoustics of the instrument.
Can somebody do that for the oboe?
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, the short answer is that German bassoon just became much easier to play. It became easier to blend with, mm-hmm. and just kind of all around. I don't know. People just, I think, unfortunately, too many people stopped playing French bassoon. Mm-hmm. But there's still a lot of people that do it. And the sort of modern, this current generation of French bassoonists play, you know, they can blend, they play very well in tune. So the problems of the past that the French bassoon had have definitely been overcome now. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe for my own listening pleasure, I kind of wish that modern French bassoonists would be a little bit closer to the Allard sound. But, you know, it just doesn't really make sense anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, Allard did actually play quite sharp, because it was just, you know, the 50s and 60s. His sound didn't blend very well. He played extremely loud because he kind of couldn't really play that quiet because it was just too hard. And you don't want those qualities in modern orchestras today. So, but if you listen to like Gilbert Odin, he sounds really great. And he has this great fusion of sort of old Allard and new modern style. And there's, you know, it's a huge range. It's a spectrum of French bassoonists. I mean, they don't all sound a certain way. It's just like German bassoonists. Like Ben Kamen sounds different from Frank Morelli, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a huge difference there. And it's just like that with French bassoonists too.
Well, and in terms of the French bassoon in America, am I correct in that as American orchestras started to emerge, Europeans would come over and play, and different orchestras would be either French wind sections or German wind sections? Like Boston cool. had French bassoons.
Yeah, the principal bassoonist of Boston for many, many years was the uncle of Maurice Allard, oddly. His name was Raymond Allard. And yeah, there that sort of tradition of wind playing, like tabuteau, of course, really influenced the American style. So I think some of like these long lines of American players or the, you know, American style, it definitely is influenced by those old French bassoonists from the New York Phil, Boston, and all that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so my next question is about solo repertoire and range, because as you mentioned, the French bassoon has much smaller bore, and so it plays high notes much really well. Easier, right? And so, like, let's not even get into the high Fs, okay? We all know, but like, even like Tonsman Sonatine, E, 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 and you're just supposed to like fart out a high E with no preparation at all.
And it's so hard on German bassoon.
It's like, but it, okay, so I guess my two-parter question here, I will do a two-parter, is one, does that enter like this is a transcription territory in your mind? And two, yeah. If yes, or I guess even if no, do you advocate for the changing of octaves, the adding, like I've heard many people, maybe even myself, add a little yeah. E flat glisten into the high E or whatnot. Like, what are you get what I'm talking about here. What are your thoughts on that?
It comes up with students a lot. So they want to play these concord pieces because they're awesome, right? But it's like, you must be this tall to like ride the ride or something. And I don't think it's a big deal. Like if I have a student that doesn't ever read or they're, I mean, my bassoon plays high notes really poorly, really. Like I have to have a special vocal for stuff like that. And I would rather them not stress and try to like make a Frankenstein read just so they can get that one note.
Right.
Like that's because I know French bassoon. Like the composers that wrote that stuff weren't thinking like, oh yeah, like this is gonna be so impressive. Oh my God, like high Fs and E's, that is nuts. No, it's so easy on French bassoon that it's like an afterthought. Doesn't matter. Like, yeah, it's the high point of the piece or something, but there are so many harder things especially for French bassoon, because the technique is so bonkers, mm-hmm. that are in the piece earlier instead of those high notes. So I personally, just based on that, I personally don't think that it's some grand achievement to play that high F or that high E, especially in Tonsman. Like, you can, if you have like a nice diminuendo on that E, that's more important because it just sort of evaporates. Mm-hmm. And you're gonna lose that sort of character if you're going da 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 da. You know, you ruin the whole. That's not what Tonsman wanted. You ruin
it's
the whole.
It's a butt clencher. You do on the German bassoon. You're stressed out, and maybe the whole darn thing went well, and you went, this recording rides or dies on this note that's about to happen. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you anyway.
So my opinion, controversial yet brave, is screw it. It doesn't matter. Like, it's easy for French bassoon, so it's not even a big deal for them. It wasn't a big deal for the composer. So why do German bassoonists freak out so much about it?
Yeah, I guess that's my, you kind of already answered, but you know, I think of those pieces as so hard, like even Bisch concertino or something like that. And my next question was the experience of playing those on the French bassoon is not that they become easy, but do they seem just kind of more sensical, especially for that age group on the French bassoon?
Absolutely. I mean, it just becomes just another phrase. Because the bore of the French bassoon really is a lot smaller. And something I play on I have a standard French bassoon that's really old, and then this hybrid bassoon that was made by a Parisian maker that sort of has somewhat German fingerings. And so I'll take that to IDRS conferences with him because he's trying to sell them and I like them, and you know, I might get comped for whatever for helping him. But one of the first things I do for people if they want to try it is I say, okay, press this F key and then try double tonguing, and everybody can do it. Like, it's that free blowing. So mm-hmm. that's just it's just what it can do. And so if you're playing Bisch or Dutilleux or anything like that, it becomes a lot more fun. More fun than playing it on German bassoon,
yeah.
Because it's easier and you can phrase more with it. Like, you're not just like, well, I'm gonna get it and that's about all I can do with it. You can't put it into any sort of phrasing context or something like that.
Exactly.
So yeah, it does become quite a bit more fun. But yeah, like you're saying, ride or die. I like that. It doesn't. I don't think it. You know, if I was listening to a student or a professional at some live recital and they didn't get the high note, I'm not going to be like, oh God, we ruined the recital.
They suck.
They suck.
My pearls.
No way. No way. I think it's just, you know, that's just the instrument that was written for. It's a different instrument. Yeah.
Okay, I'm done. Go for it, Galit. Sacre bleu. We are done with the French bassoon questions. I'm sorry to our French listeners. We do have them.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
sorry. Sorry, guys.
We don't speak French. Okay. So, Darren, this is a hard left from what we were talking about, but you and I recently collaborated on a forthcoming project to come out probably next year sometime. Mm-hmm. And I, in this process, was struck down dead by your incredible preparation.
Oh, thank you.
And I would love to ask you about how you prepare for major projects, because it was, honestly, it was so amazing.
It's born out of anxiety. I am a very anxious person. I mean, I didn't do all that. Like, I got the idea originally from a masterclass that Joe Robinson did, where he was saying that he had, during one of his 9-to-5 jobs, I think he was like a security guard, he would go through the score and just, you know, furiously mark up orchestra parts to just then have in his library. Like, he would put, you know, plus clarinet, or mm-hmm. this is the third, or, you know, with cellos, or you know, really, really detailed notes. And so I just started doing that when I would sub with bigger orchestras, just to be like, okay, you know, I'm the peon here. I am not messing up. So I would really do a lot of part prep. And I just kind of continued doing that because I hate feeling nervous in a rehearsal. I mean, with you guys, I didn't know you guys very well. I didn't know what your playing was like. You know, it's the unknown that usually freaks me out. And of course, you're all lovely and you all sound amazing. So I'm actually very glad that I was prepared. but you never know. It really is kind of, it's not born out of anxiety. I hate feeling anxious and I hate not knowing what's going on in my part. I hate that so much that I spend several hours marking up a score.
You not only marked up your part, you wrote new parts.
Well, yeah, that was because, no shade to Michael, but some of the page turns and things like that. Well, so think about the first of the Ligeti, where mm-hmm. I just play a low A for two pages.
Yeah.
I would get lost extremely easily. And there's that one part where it sort of turns into we made it 5/8 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I miscount one measure, like I screw up the whole take, I'm not mm-hmm. going to be with the horn. Mm-hmm. And so that alone, I mean, I'm pretty quick with notation software. So when I made my new part, it didn't even take me like 2 hours. So it wasn't really some big effort. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do it because I just want to feel in control, secure, because mm-hmm. there's enough to worry about. Mm-hmm. Like reads and response and intonation, like just if you can do something before rehearsal that makes everything easy, just do it.
Yeah, that's fabulous advice. That's fabulous advice.
Could we ask you to look back over the course of your career and tell us about a memory that is very special to you or holds a significant place in your heart as you look back?
I would say there was one recently that I felt very kind of cool doing it. So, you know, my research with French bassoon, I studied language in my doctorate and I did some intensive, language seminar or like a language class in Paris and things like that. So really trying to work hard to learn the language so I can talk to these people, learn from them and stuff like that. So that was such a huge effort, almost like a bigger effort than learning the instrument is trying to learn sort of semi-fluency in that language. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if I was asked or if I asked to play in basically the France version of IDRS. It's called Association Basson or something like that. And so myself and clarinet colleague Robin Jones, we played the Poulenc duo for clarinet bassoon. And I played it on French bassoon. And I mean, the performance went well. I mean, I don't play that well on French bassoon. So there was definitely things that I'm just like, Jesus, I'm embarrassed playing in front
of a bunch of French people.
I know. It was like, okay. But there was this thing that I wanted to do where I prepared like some short remarks and I did it in French. And, I had a little piece of paper to help me if I got lost or something. But it was like a very heartfelt thing. Like, you know, I really love the French bassoon. I wish more people played it. Thank you for having me. You know, think like something that's very sincere that was saying, hey, I see you guys. I think you guys are amazing. and I just got this huge, like thunderous applause after I did this thing in French. And I just thought like, wow, like that was exactly how I wanted that to go. Aww. But then but here's the funny thing. After we got done playing, the applause was not as loud as the remarks.
They were like, it's a great effort.
They're like, it's really okay. That oh la la.
We need recently those humbling moments. That's really
It was definitely a scary performance, but it did go well. It was just funny that they were probably maybe more impressed by my language than my playing.
Well, I tried to start ordering a crepe in Provence and they wouldn't let me get past the first word. So you must have done a pretty good job because they were not having my 2 years of high school en français.
I know. That's the hard thing, is everybody's really great with English, so it's a hard, mm-hmm. it's hard to practice. It's I think I speak the best French when I'm with people that either refuse to speak English or don't speak it very well, because you just have to make it work. You have to make mm-hmm. it happen. And like that French maker that makes my sort of hybrid bassoon, he's sort of like that. So I've spent a lot of time with him, and it's just exhausting to just really try to speak the language, but it's fun. It's rewarding. It makes me feel kind of, I don't know. It's something that I always wanted to do, never thought I really would, but to actually see it happen is kind of fun.
That is beautiful and heartwarming. And now I'm wondering if you would be willing to share a less heartwarming memory, perhaps something funny or embarrassing that happened to you on stage.
I've got a very good one, and people have probably heard this story too many times, but everybody knows Kurt Mazur is sort of like this crazy dictator conductor, right? And he was doing sort of a conducting seminar for conducting students at MSM once. And, you know, I had a lot going on or something. I don't know what my excuse was. I'm full of them, but I had to play contra on Shostakovich 6, not taking it very seriously. Maybe I didn't even practice it at all. And he yells at me. So I guess my intonation wasn't very good, but just in front of the whole orchestra, all the students, even faculty were there, he goes, "Contrabassoon, your intonation is criminal." And I just wanted to die, you know. I was like, I don't even like this thing. Stop yelling at me. But yeah, to have like a very famous conductor yell at you directly is pretty humiliating.
That's incredible. Criminal?
But basically I went crying to Judy and I'm just like, Kurt Mazur. She's like, oh my God, the amount of times that he has said that to people, don't even worry. He's just, he's got that cocked and loaded at all times. So I was like, okay, he's just being dramatic.
He's like, you should be put in jail.
I know. I had a heart attack. It's like, was it that bad? I mean, was I a half step sharp or flat? I don't even know. It is hard though. Like I had to, when I was in Lawrence at KU, I happily got called to sub a lot with Kansas City Symphony, but it was always on contra. So the problem is, if you get called pretty often, you start to have to be like, it's like, okay, I think I need to learn the scale after all.
Yeah.
Because it's very different. You know, certain notes, sharp or flat, that aren't that way on your bassoon. And it's hard. I don't dislike it because it sounds bad or anything like that. I have a hard time with contra because it's so difficult, you know?
All right. Our concluding question is always, what advice do you have for a young musician who aspires to have a career like yours?
I would say that being a professor, you kind of you do a lot of things. It's more than just playing in tune and playing with good phrasing. Like, orchestra members do the same thing. They have a lot of outreach responsibilities. So it's sort of similar, orchestra and professor. But the biggest thing that I had to catch up on was my writing skills, because I went to two conservatories. I never had a university experience before KU. Mm-hmm. So my writing was just like, oh, it was so bad. But luckily I had Eric Sommer being my teacher. He would, you know, edit things and help me with writing. Like, he basically taught me how to write as an adult or as, you know, in an academic way. Yeah, exactly. he has like all the patience in the world. But yeah, so there are different areas of being a professor, like writing and serving on committees, balancing that kind of thing. Also being able to teach, articulate your ideas, speak up. Like, I'm a very soft-spoken person. I actually hate it when people tell me that, but it's true. But, you know, sort of presenting yourself in an authoritative way. There's just a lot of sort of other things that you need to develop. if you want to become a professor. And some people come by it naturally. I don't actually think I do. I've had to work at a lot of these areas, you know, being decisive on search committees or speaking up during faculty senate or, you know, sending out emails to the whole faculty and making sure that, like, oh, I'm going to proofread this email 10 times so there's no typos. You know, it's like that kind of pressure. It sounds silly, but...
No, it doesn't to me. That all sounds like painfully similar.
Yeah, because it's just not really my personality to just easily do those things, just to be outspoken and externally confident and things like that. So I think maybe just students being ready for that or knowing kind of to expect that. And if you can work on yourself outside of music, because you're going to be more hireable and better suited for the job once you get it. If you've sort of developed more than just your scales and long tones, and it's not only about being a fantastic musician, you have to have all kinds of professional skills.
Darren, this was so much fun. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for joining us on Double Read Dish.
Thank you guys. This was absolutely fun for me too.
I know. I don't even have to hope. I know that you enjoyed that interview. Okay. So follow us on social media. If you haven't joined the consortium and you're planning to do that, go ahead and do that.
Yeah, we want you to.
We want you. The more the merrier.
Mm-hmm.
Enter the redecorating contest.
Yeah, we really want you to do that.
Go check out that Halloween merch and mm-hmm. treat yourself. Mm-hmm. And
take pictures of it when you get it so that we can post it on social media.
Yes. Great. Yes. Thank you, Galit. Send us pictures of you in your merch and we will repost and talk about how cute you are. And rate and review, subscribe, follow. We love you and thank you for tuning in. Galit, who do we have on our next frightful October episode?
Ooh, we have Mayu Isom, member of the Houston Grand Opera and Houston Ballet. We can't wait to share that interview with you. Jackie, let's end this nerd parade.
Go make reeds that are decorated for the contest.